Hello and welcome to the GMS Magazine podcast. This is the Interview Room, the show in which I am lucky enough to get together with some of the best or even the best people in the world of role-playing games and board games and ask them a ton of questions. I am Paco Garcia, your host, and today I have with me Lisbeth Boss, a name who's got, well, literally dozens of games listed under her name in the Board Game Geek. Lisbeth has been designing games for children for, well, years and years, or I should say co-designing, but she will tell us everything about it. If you would like to be featured or come to the podcast or to sponsor the show, please do get in touch because we would love to hear from you. You can get in touch with me on podcast@gmsmagazine.com, that is my email, or by all means do get in touch in Twitter. I am @gmsmagazine. And my co-host, who is not with me for this interview, but he's, well, a lot of times, Chris Diaz. He is Diaz Ex Machina in Twitter, and you can find him as well in Facebook. And of course, you can get in touch with me as well in Facebook on my website and Facebook page, GMS Magazine. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble any longer. I think this was a very good, very interesting interview, and I loved having Lisbeth around. So, see you later. Lisbeth, welcome to the show after probably about 6 months trying to get this interview sorted and arranged. Was it October when we first spoke?
I really don't know, but thank you for having me. And let's make it worth the wait.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, absolutely. I have absolutely zero doubts because there are two areas that I am very, very interested in talking to you about. One is about you. Because even though your name is not one of those names that are constantly in people's mouths regarding game design, but you have 38 games to your credit, and some of them are...
I do?
Well, that's what the Board Game Geek says when I look for your name. So I must believe that, I guess. There are an awful lot of them. No, well, you know, one does their homework, sort of, a little bit. Not really. And the other thing is that you're also collaborating with my favorite crowdfunding platform. So there are these two things that I want to talk about. But for people who don't know who you are or what you look like or what kind of human being you actually are, tell me about you and your gaming history, because there's going to be a lot of it.
Okay. Well, I look like this.
Which people for the podcast... Yeah, imagine it. That's fine. Go and find it. You know, it's
and my gaming history is actually, I sort of happened to roll into the business. I'm an industrial designer and I design toys, and I always went to Nuremberg to the Spielwarenmesse, the biggest toy fair in the world, and I used to play games, you know, with my dad mostly, also with my mom. And then, you know, I would buy games, but the Netherlands didn't have that many games. So when I went to the toy fair, I would always swing by the game hall just to look at games for me personally, but never thinking that this is a job. And then one of my friends said, well, Klaus Teuber is really raking it in. Like, who's Klaus Teuber? I have no clue. Sorry. And he's like, well, that's the designer of Catan. And then it hit me. Somebody designs games. That's a job you can do. And as I was preparing for the toy fair anyway, I thought, you know what? I'll make a game because I'm going to go to the hall anyway. So I'll bring a game. I never knew that that was difficult. So I brought a game, showed it around. There was this guy... Michael Bleinsma from 99 Games that I showed it to. He loved it. He took me around, introduced me to everybody, and the game got signed right away. So once you're signed, you're, you know, an author on a box or a designer on a box. So after that, it was easier to pitch games and sell games. And then gradually, my job shifted from toy design to game design. Which is great, because the toy world is like a city and the game world is like a village. Everybody knows each other, it's friendly, it's warm. So, yeah.
What are the main, actually, this is very interesting. You mentioned about the difference between the city and the village, because I know very little about toy design. The only toy designer I've ever interviewed was somebody from Lego. And I have to say, Lego was an absolutely incredible company to interview and to interact with. They were so, so warm and so welcoming and so utterly lovely that it felt like, okay, this is quite
Lego,
an industry.
Lego is like its thing on its own. Because after I became a game designer, at one point Lego asked me to be a consultant for them. And they flew me into Billund. Mm-hmm. And then you get into your childhood's dream. It really is. It's everything you think Lego is about. It's true. You have these walls behind you. I was working for Duplo, for them, consulting for Duplo. There are these walls with Duplo, but they have the same at Lego. And you can just, you know, you go around with a little tray. You pick anything you want, and you build, and you discuss, and blah, 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 blah. And then, because this was like a brainstorm session with designers and me as a consultant. And then, because you know, this is what the mom taught me, so we're like, okay, this we're not going to continue with. There are all these empty tables. So mm-hmm. you put your buildings or your stuff on a table and you go to the next. Like, you know, we need more space. You just go to the next. So at the end of the day, we decided, okay, this is what we're going to use. That we're not going to use. So I started breaking it apart and putting it back. And they're like, what are you doing? So, my mom taught me. We have staff for that. So there's absolutely somebody's job is to demolish the non-good designs and put them back in the right boxes. It's like, wow. Wow. And the other thing, this was another dream. There was actually a slide from the second floor to the first floor.
Oh, yes. My.
Yes. And I'm like, why don't we use it? They're like, well, at first everybody does, but it's very noisy. So everybody took the stairs, and I'm like, no. So I took the slide down. It's like, why not? You know.
That is that's amazing.
Yeah, they had me as a consultant twice, and I was like,
more, please, more times. So what are the main differences between, apart from Lego, of course, but what are the main differences between working in game design and working in toy design? Because you've obviously decided to stay in game design. There must be a reason for that.
Toy design, I don't know. There was a lot of, like, the first thing I ever made was a puzzle. And that was actually, well, it's a big compliment, but you see this puzzle all over the world.
Right.
Everybody copied it. So if my first company would have, you know, been better at protecting that, you know, be in my castle now doing this interview. But yeah, there's a lot of things get stolen. There's a lot of threats like, well, but if you do this, then I'll sue you. And at one point I made a design for a rattle, which was for a company that did these bead and wire mazes. So I made like a butterfly rattling toy for that. And this was my design. And I worked with that company on that. And then when we got to Nuremberg, another company had the same design, more or less. Actually, uglier than mine.
Ouch.
And we knew that I was first, but the other company threatened them. So they were like, we don't know what to do. So and these things, you hurt them all the time.
That sounds stressful. That sounds very stressful.
It was.
So now you're happier creating games. What kind of games do you create? What moves you?
What moves me? I do children's games because I was a toy designer. So and also I designed a toy for Haba. Actually, this is how it also started. Well, this first game got signed, and then there's this preview show in Nuremberg when the game came out, and then my toy company from Thailand, they were there too, and my publisher from Germany with my game. And then the toy company guy said, hey, you did games too, we want a game. And this company was more or less like Haba. They had cloth, they had wood, they had cardboard. And I'm thinking, if I make a game for them, I have to use what they have, which is which was The Princess and the Pea, which is this game with the mattresses and the pillows and a little bed. They ended up not doing it. So then I thought, okay, now I have this very expensive game that nobody else can do but Haba. So there's only one chance. I'll bring it to Haba and I'll see what they do. And they're like, oh! Which is what I hope for. And yeah, so they took that. And I don't really like, well, it's difficult. It's different because I work for these American companies who have a lot of text in their games. But as a game designer, I want things. I once talked to Johan Guttinger. I don't know if you know him. Hi, Hasen in der Abendsonne, the former Drei Magier Spiele.
The name does ring a bell. I cannot say I know the man.
Okay, well, he once told me, he's like, what I want if you design a game for kids is you open the box, you put the rules aside, you see the material, and you're like, oh yes, I want to do this, and I know what to do. So based on that thought, I was laying in bed one time and I was thinking, so what if I open a box, what do I see, and what immediately do I know what to do? And then I made a game with horses and lassos, and but the company then changed the theme, but we were capturing people with lassos, and I didn't like how they made it, but the idea was you open the box, you know immediately what to do. That's what I like, that's what I go for.
You know, I wish more companies made games for adults with that idea in mind, because one of the things that absolutely frustrates me no end is when you open a box and you have to spend 20 minutes figuring out how to set up the game. So then you can start reading the rules to learn how to play the game. And then you start reading the rules. And I'm an instructional designer. And I cannot stop thinking, why don't you hire an instructional designer so the rules are explained the way they should? So
this is funny, because I sometimes proofread the rules for Thunderworks games. Mm-hmm. And they're, of course, an American company, with, and I'm not a native speaker. But because of that, I see some mistakes, or I see things that are not logical to me. Also, because I'm not really a gamer. So, you know, if you're a first-time gamer and open a rule book, and I have been in it with my red pencil, then I found things that the normal or the avid gamer will not think about explaining. I was like, but I missed this, or I would like a picture here explaining what to do. And usually those things get added to the rule book or changed. Not always, but we talk about it, or it gets explained better to me why it's in there, and then I understand. What I know Thunderworks does is they write your rules right from the start. And then they work on the game, and in the meantime work on the rules, because you know the game changes a little bit, so the rules change a little bit. But you have to change the rules, and they have to be as accurate as possible, because we have to send them to test players. So there's, from the beginning, there's always like a prototype, and there's rules. It cannot be without rules. Unless you're the designer showing the game, pitching.
What is your favorite process about making a game, actually? What is that you start thinking about a game and think, this is, I'm going to enjoy this particular part?
When I work on a game, it's usually with my co-designer in the recent years. We design children's games, and we always have this story in our head, like with one of our latest games, it's Fuck Monster. It's there's a stack up there, so I'm looking at it. And with Sock Monster, we thought about people always losing their socks.
Right.
You know, this is the classic thing, and how come you lose your sock? And that's because there's a sock monster who collects it. And then we got to talk with one of our editors, and she said, well, how about, because we needed a world for the sock monsters, and she said, how about the sock monsters live in the back of the washing machine? And so, you know, and when you have this story, then it's easy to come up with a gameplay. We always need to have a story that matches with the material. And the other thing that I like is that we want to have, with my co-designer Anya Kaya-Brückner, I like to mention her, we like to have a gimmick, something three-dimensional or a gimmick, or at one point she came to my place and she said, I have this idea. And she had a piece of cardboard with a glue gun. She made stripes on it. Mm-hmm. And then she had a 12-sided die and a cup over it, or a half dome ball or something. And she's like, look how it moves. I'm like, wow, it's cool. It feels really nice. And you see it move. We're like, what are we going to do with it? And we were playing around with it. We couldn't figure it out. So then we had lunch. And then after lunch, I'm like, I have an idea. And I just took some aluminum foil, crumpled it up, and then made it flat. And we're like, this is our game board. We're now in space, right? And we put the die over it, and it just rolled over that thing. And then we thought, okay, well, of course, you're not going to use aluminum foil. Does it work with a normal piece of paper? And then we thought, well, what can this crumpled paper be? And we're like, okay, this can be the desert. This can be a treasure island for a pirate game. And, you know, even it could be a soccer field. We had lots of themes for that. It could be a soccer field, because the soccer field is always also uneven. And then the ball rolls because it's uneven. And when we pitched that game to publishers, it was really nice. We're like, we had this nice A4 piece of paper. We're like, okay, we have this idea, and we put the die on it, and we put the cup on it, and then you move and you lift the cup, and then the die should change, but it didn't change. So we look at each other. We're like, okay, this idea is rubbish. I'll just crumple it up. And the publisher were like, what are you doing? Oh yeah, it's just rubbish. And then we flattened it. Now it's a game. And then we showed it. And, that also got taken, where that was like the first children's legacy game where you play it once and then you throw it away for real. But yeah, things like that. We like to have something different. I mean, there's 1,000 memo games. We don't want to have the next memo game. There's an enormous amount of speed games for kids. You're like, yeah, yawn. We don't want another speed game for kids. So. No offense. I mean, they're very good speed games. They're also very good memo games. And eventually our publisher for Buck Monsters used some memo elements that we necessarily didn't have in the game at first. Mm-hmm. But it works out well. It's great. But yeah, those are our golden rules. Like, no memo, no speed, and add something three-dimensional, something quirky, some other materials, some gimmick.
It sounds like the sort of game that I could not possibly design, I have to say. I think you have to have some sort of special kind of mind to be able to design a game based on something as abstract as that. And I admire people who can do it, because it would be completely impossible for me to think about.
Yeah, this just happened. I mean, we talked together. We met at the SAS, the German Game Designers Association. Mm-hmm. We met at one of those parties, and Anya was immediately like, we should work together. And I'm like, back then I was coming from the toy world, like, how do I protect my ideas? And then Lego happened. And Lego sent me this agreement, but I'm like, but people, I'm coming over and you need me as a consultant, but what if I bring a game to the table and you're making millions of, how are we gonna do that? No, full of myself. And they're like, But that's not how it works. We're going to work in a team. That's not how it works. But how? Lego, that's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So, of course, I'm going to go, and of course, I'm going to do this. And then I learned with Lego that exactly, that's not how it works. You do this, the other person does that, and then you go to lunch, and I'm like, but, you know, the waitress does something on the table. You're like, oh, wow, I just had a brainwave. And so when I came back from Lego, I called Anya. It's like, I know how to do it. I know how to do it. But we were both still like, but are we going to give away our good ideas? So I'm just like, you know what? I have drawers full of ideas that I think were good, but they're crappy, but they have something. So I'm just going to show you some of those. And then you bring some of yours, and then we'll see what we do. She's like, sure, let's do that. So then she came to my house, and I had my idea on the table. And she's like, yeah, you sent me that. And you were right. That was utter crap. And I'm like, okay. The mood is set here. And then she's like, but. And then she takes a box out of her bag, opens the box. And she says, I have this. And this is utter crap, too. And she just stands in front of my table. She just tips it over. And there's like this, my game had little discs. And hers were like a Mikado. Mm-hmm. So we have these discs with a Mikado thrown over it. And it's a gigantic mess. And we're like looking at it. And we look at each other. And we're like, now we have a game. But we didn't know what to do with it. But I think 10 years later or so, I woke up with the words needle in, or the, yeah, words needle in a haystack. And I was playing around with needle in a haystack. Because like, yeah, of course, needle in a haystack. That's a game. And as I was making a prototype, I'm like, oh my God, that's our first game. So I called Anya, I was like, I made it. We have our first game, and it's also produced, so it's kind of cool.
That eureka moment must be absolutely wonderful to have.
Yeah, but I mean, when we had that moment, we knew, okay, this is how we both like to work. But that game, you know, never happened until 10 years later or so.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, the idea that just looking at something, you can think, oh, yeah. Even if it happens 10 years later, I mean, that must be an incredible feeling. I think that.
Oh, yeah, like the other one, Polo Party. We were working with all these, like I said, we're crumbling up papers and playing with dice over it and doing different things involved. We had different stuff that we were doing with the crumbled paper. And we got the game signed, but we worked at Anya has a, she works from home, but she also has a studio somewhere in our town where she lives. So she said, I was at my studio, you know, cleaning up the mess that we made. And I saw all these crumpled papers. And then I just thought, they look like icebergs. So she calls me up, I'm not gonna throw it away. We made icebergs, so let's make a game. And we always, when we get together, we work on projects that we're already working on, but then there's always like the last 5 minutes of the day, we're like, let's do dessert. And in dessert, we'll just poop out a game in 5 minutes. So we like, oh, the icebergs, let's, you know, wait, move them to dessert. And then we made a game in 5 minutes, and it's
is that,
we think it's really cool.
That is incredible. How has changed your design methodology over the years? I mean, what do you do now that you didn't used to do when you started designing games?
Oh, I take that. That's also because of Anya. We take leaps instead of tiny steps.
Right.
And also when we design a game and we think, okay, this is cool what we have, we look at the material and we become the publisher and we think, no, way too expensive. So we're like, oh, so you have three dice, custom dice. That's going to be expensive. How about, and we just take away the dice and we throw them away. You play the game without dice. And we're like, that's impossible. We just designed the whole game around these dice. And we're like, yeah, but this, we're the publisher now and we threw away the dice. So what are you going to do? And we're like, okay, we'll see. And, you know, we challenge ourselves that way. And then usually when we start with one thing and we throw stuff away, then we end up with 10 more projects. So it's always like growing, but it's also good. You like, less is more. Another thing is the attention span for from kids,
right,
is very low. A game should not last longer than 7 minutes max. Also, the rules should not be longer than one A4.
Mm-hmm.
It should also be interesting for the parents. So there's a lot of things, a lot of boxes to tick, and all of that has to be crammed into a game that has to be very simple and has replayability. So it's a challenge.
I'm curious about something, because over the last few years, thank goodness, there's been a lot more awareness about children with neurodiversities. How do you cater for that? And at what point do you start to think, well, children might be dyslexic, or they may have color blindness, or this game for a child with autism may not work, or, but if we do this, it may. Do you at some point go through a process of making the games accessible for neurodiverse kids?
No, because color blindness is something for the publisher to solve
okay.
in different ways with patterns or something else. What was the other thing you said? The first one?
Dyslexia, for instance, could be.
Well, we have no words.
Okay.
So that's easy. No, but in between the toys and the games, I was also and have been for a longer time a designer for educational products,
right?
Educational games, and there was. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Montessori, Maria Montessori.
No.
She was this educator who developed products for the Montessori schools, and but those products were limited. I don't know how many there are, but that's a limited range, and you cannot make more because they have to be designed by her. So then there was this other company, Toys for Life, that they were like, okay, we're going to use this philosophy from Maria Montessori and want to design or want to have games that teach kids things based on her theories. And I made for them, I made about 14 products, I think. So you can add those to the
okay.
38. So I made some products for them. And there it was very important to think about how are you going to teach a child how to read, how simply to follow, you go from left to right and from top to bottom, because kids don't know that at first. And following rules and making, and there you have, because usually a children's game has like one rule and that this is it. But there you have, it's more like a video game. You play this game, you understand what you're doing. Now we're gonna level up.
Okay.
And now we're gonna level up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So every game there had, I don't know how many levels. You could play it solo, you could play it with multiple players. You also had to be, you had to be able to check if you did it right. So it was more like doing a task, and then at the end you had to figure out if you did it right. There I did more, I did those things more. Recently Gameland made a game, like a reprint of one of those games for the normal market, but that's because, or the normal market, that's more for China, for Chinese parents who want to sort of homeschool their kids. So it's more of an educational game line for China.
Interesting. And knowing, I mean, the things that you've changed from the past and the way they used to design and the way that you design now, what for you, what's been the biggest, or what have been the biggest changes within the gaming industry since you started designing games?
We recently had a lot of discussions about this, and we have divided children in two groups. You have the Haba kids. And you have the gamers kids. When you go on the Facebook groups, people like to tell how old their kid is and that they already played Scythe or something, or Blood Rage or whatever. I'm exaggerating, but
well, you'd say that, but I know people say, "Oh, my 13-year-old is already playing, you know, Agra."
But I'm talking about the 5-year-olds, the 5-year-olds that already play, I don't know,
Carcassonne. Or...
Yeah, but of course, they can play Carcassonne because they played with their parents, and their parents helped them. So if you, and this is the problem. This is why also children's games not always get the highest rates on BoardGameGeek. Because, for example, My Sleepy Princess, which has sold a lot and has sold over 10 years or more. But people then on BoardGameGeek keep type in like not a lot of replayability. Well, no. No, because a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old wants to repeat the same thing over and over again. And they don't want an extra ability card that will change what they do. No, they want to play the same game and they want to play it over and over again. And that's their replayability. They don't want it different. They want it the same. And that's one of the things that Anya and I always notice when we test our games. We test a game, we see, okay, we played it with these kids, they were all bored, so it's clearly broken, so we need to fix it. So we fix it, and we want to test it again with the same kids, and the kids go, no. We're like, well, this rule changed, you now have to do this. And they're like, no, that's not how this game goes. But it was boring. Yes, but this is how it goes. They want to play the same thing. So if you design for the Haba kids, it's a different design than for the gamers kids.
Right.
So that's what we're struggling with at the moment.
So demographics matter a lot.
Yeah.
Interesting. That is, it's not something that I would have thought about. I mean, because I don't do children's games. I don't tend to play them very often because I don't have children near me. I don't think about these sort of things. And I wonder how many parents, even parents who buy children's games, think about that sort of, you know, is this game the kind of game that is okay for my kid? Are they going to enjoy it? Or do I have to enjoy the game for my kid to actually enjoy it? And I wonder how many of these gaming parents will think, oh, I'm not going to play this. My kid is not going to like this game because I am not going to like this game. Well, I wonder how often that happens.
Yeah.
Okay, so knowing with all of that, I would like to jump a little bit because we're already going on to 35 minutes of interview, which is wonderful. So I would like to go a bit into your cooperation with Game on Tabletop because it's a company that I am absolutely in love with. I really love what they do. I think they are wonderful people. And I know that you're working with them, which it's only going to enhance the profile of the company. But I'm still not entirely sure what exactly are you doing with them?
Well, this is the thing. I met Laura at Gamma, and we were talking. Also, before that, we were talking a little bit online. But at Gamma, I met her, and you met Laura, of course.
Yeah.
And when you meet Laura, you fall in love. You're like, I'm sorry. She's
fantastic.
She's great.
Yeah.
She's great, and she knows everything, and she knows everybody, and she's really smart, and she's bubbly, and she's a very great personality.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I told her the first day, it's like, I want to work for you. And she's like, but what are you going to do? It's like, I don't know, we'll figure it out, but I want to work for you. And then after Gamma, well, we stayed in touch and we were, you know, sort of bouncing ideas of each other. So what can it be? Because she also wanted to work with me, but we didn't know what it should be. And we thought about sales. But then I said, well, I think because she also showed me your video to explain how Game on Tabletop works. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow. And I did the tour too. She took me on a tour through the tool. And I was blown away. It's like, wow, everybody is always doing things on Kickstarter. I mean, the companies I work for are Kickstarter companies. And I totally understand that they are. But if you see the things that you have to do, you have to unlock your stretch goals, and you have to manage the pledge manager thing, and people, there are so many things that Game on Tabletop has automatically because they started because they couldn't go on Kickstarter, so they made their own tool and just used whatever they thought they needed to do, which has all the intuitive things that, you know, you would want Kickstarter has. So Game on Tabletop has that. So once they told me that, I'm like, okay, so we have this really great tool, but we're not that well known. So how about I work on that? How about we'll try and get you on more interviews? And then we started our own channel with Celine, and Celine's also great.
She's wonderful. She's absolutely
wonderful. Sometimes she does all these characters, and she wears hats and stuff, and it's great. So I'm working actually very closely with Celine. And so what I do is I find people in the industry. So what we're trying to do is to show the backers and the creators what it needs from, I have an idea for a game, to have it actually on a table in somebody's home. So who else is involved? So you have the game designer, but you have the publisher, or you become the publisher, but you also need a manufacturer. You need a graphic designer. You need somebody to edit the rules. You need the reviewers. And also in reviewers, you have so many people. You have people who do reviewers. You have people who do unboxings. You have people who 1 minute videos and have the podcasters. So we're like, okay, let's interview everybody to sort of show the backers also, because the backers can sometimes be ruthless, like, where's my game? Well, somewhere along those lines, from the scribble to being on your table, there are so many people involved, so many things that can go wrong. So we're trying to educate them, but in a nice way, short interviews. So I do research on the people. I usually make the questions, and then Celine does the interviews, and she does them very well because she's very engaged.
Mm-hmm.
She's not just, you know, asking the questions.
She's very good. She's very, very good.
So that's what I do. And then we have this chat, and sometimes things come up, and I'm like, what about, can we do this? Can we do that? And then the other day we had a meeting and Laura was introducing me. So like, yeah, Lisbeth always has like crazy ideas. And we sometimes have to like, no, we can't, but she pushes, she triggers. So that's my job.
Okay. That sounds actually very, very good. I do like the sound of that, because creativity is something that you can never have enough, and having new ideas,
exactly,
and good ideas is very good. And obviously, you know games, you know gamers, and you know the industry. So from that point of view, I think it makes perfect sense. Where in talking about not just a game on tabletop in particular, but also crowdfunding in general, you're obviously experienced because, as you mentioned, some of your companies, the companies you work for, are Kickstarter companies. But where do you think crowdfunding is going in the future? I mean, what's going to happen there, since you're in the inside?
I don't really know what's going to happen with Kickstarter right now, the blockchain thing. I'm not that knowledgeable about it. I really don't know what's going to happen. I think that more and more people are going towards crowdfunding. That's the only way, or it seems the only way to be able to fund games. Recently, with everything happening in the world, with the pandemic, prices went up, shipments went up. So you need to have some sort of capital to afford it all. The prices of games are gonna go up. Yes, and in a way, I can see that can be a problem, of course, because, you know, you have to be able to afford it. On the other hand, I think I always compare it like the money versus the time. So if I go to the movies and I spend 20 euros, then, you know, it, also I sleep, so the movie only lasts 10 minutes for me, so that's a lot of money for 10 minutes of fun. But if I buy a game for 50 euros or 100 euros, and it gives me evenings and evenings of fun, and it gives me, because this was another idea I had the other day, it's like, how can we show a game, people do the unboxings and stuff. Actually, the fun of the game is this table with this game played out and stuff all over the table, and there's empty bowls of chips and there's empty glasses and beers and whatever, you know, and people are they're like sweaty or red, and then, you know, they had a good time. That's what it's about. That's what you're giving. That's what the 50 euros are worth, mm-hmm. or the $100 or whatever are worth. It's endless evenings of games or of gaming. But then there's that. But then there's all, on the other hand, there's the people who, they are also on the internet, who cannot stop buying games and have the shelf of shame. You rolled your eyes, sir.
I do, because I have way too many games, and I have a hoarding complex, because it pains me no end to get rid of any of them. Whenever I have to sell any game because I literally run out of shelf space, it's painful to see a game go. I kid you not. I hate it, because as far as I'm concerned, the joy that I experience just discovering what's in the box, it's for me such a magical thing to find out what it is, and the memories that I forge whilst I'm playing. I'm a very whimsical kind of player. Some of my friends get annoyed with me because they think that I play like an idiot, because I'm always just laughing all the time and taking the piss, and I never play seriously. It doesn't matter how serious the game is, because I'm not a particularly competitive person. I like when I win,
yeah,
but I really laugh when I lose. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah,
so I keep buying games because I love them. I just love them.
Well, a couple of years ago I moved from a mansion to the tiniest place on earth. It was 24 square meters with my two kids.
Ouch.
And I wanted that.
yeah, I know, but to go from one to something so compact.
It was great. Well, this was a process. I already watched tiny houses and stuff, and I always wanted to buy it. So when the opportunity came, I'm like, yes, I want to do this. But then I had all these games in the old house, and I told the kids, there's no game kind of entering the new place unless we play it and we decide what to do with it. So we would bring home games, like stacks at a time, we would play them, and we're like, okay, this can go, this will stay, this can go, this will stay. And eventually I ended up with 11 moving boxes like this big, filled with games, and I found a game club in the Netherlands, and I'm like, please pick it up. They're like, what do you want for it? It's like, I don't want anything for it. There's trash in it, there's treasure in it, there's unopened beauties in it. It's one, you know, take it or leave it. There's no sorting through boxes. You can sell it, you can give it away, you can throw it away, you can play it, I don't care. But I think at least, you know, if I bring it to like the Goodwill store, they will, they tape the boxes shut. I hate that. That pains me. So I'm like, at least it goes to a game club, to people who are like-minded. And it felt like such a relief. They found a good home, and I'm free.
That I wish I could do. You know, the other day, and this is quite a kind of morbid thing to think about, but I was talking to a friend saying, I don't know what to do with my games when I die. I literally have no idea what to do with them.
Buy Gloomy and you can get buried in it.
Well, probably. I probably might. The thing is possible. The thing is that because most of my games are in English, and I live in Spain, and the level of English in Spain is not particularly high, above the average of the population, none of my friends are fluent enough in English that they wouldn't mind reading a book in English. They wouldn't know what to do with them. And I told them, look, if you learn English, I will put the games to you in my will. And I have about, right now, for the time being, I have about 350 board games and around 1,000 role-playing games.
Oh my God.
No, I will give them all to you if you learn English. I'm not very good with languages. What? Come on. I would learn anything if somebody was going to give me 2,000 games. Come on.
I don't know. I'm trying to learn Italian now. And it's very difficult.
Really? Yeah, well, but Spanish and Italian is fairly similar. So it was very easy for me to learn it. I have to say, I'm a forgotten now. But then I do have for a very weirdly neurodiverse person with dyslexia and dyscalculia, I have very good knack for languages. So even when the company, I used to work for a company called Computer Associates, and they would pay for people to go on one-to-one courses for languages.
Oh, that's great.
It was amazing. I learned German with a teacher called Simone. I've forgotten now because it was 20 years ago. But in about 3-4 months that I was learning German with her, I could go to Germany and, have a nice, simple, but nice conversation. So, yeah, languages, it would be, if anybody told me you have to learn this to get 4,000 games, I will go for that right away. No. No issue whatsoever. Okay, Elizabeth, to wrap it up, going back very quickly about a game on tabletop, you mentioned about how you were approaching reviewers and how you were approaching all sorts of people. For the other media people out there, because I know that we are very eager to find games, to review games, to unbox games, to interview people, what is the advice that you would have to give those people to actually be useful to the gaming community? What do we have to do for our presence to be worth it?
That's interesting. Well, as I watched also a lot of interviews in my research, and I read a lot of things, and the same things, same thing always pops up, is like, find your niche.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if everybody's doing unboxing, don't do another unboxing, for example. So find your niche. Like, some people do only two-player games or only solo games, or I don't know.
Okay. No, that actually is a very succinct but very useful piece of advice. I think that makes perfect sense. Coming from somebody who unapologetically doesn't want to fall in a niche because I just want to do what I like and I want to, you know.
But that's also a niche, maybe.
Yeah, I don't care. I just
like the Wheel of Fortune. So yeah. What are we going to get next? We don't know.
Exactly. That's how I operate. But I do like my interviews though, because I like to get to know people. That for me is important. And knowing the people behind the games, for me, it matters an awful lot, because I want to make sure that I support good people, not just anyone. But
I'm a fool.
Okay, one last question I have. Well, two last questions I have.
That's four, though.
Well, this is victory twice. Two questions I have. One is, what would be your dream game to design that you haven't designed yet?
Oh, that's the easiest one.
Okay.
The Spiel des Jahres.
Okay. Well, that's the award. But no, what would you like to see happening to that game, apart from the Spiel des Jahres, that would make you feel, that's the work of my life? That's in there.
I think Anya and I have a game that's been bugging us for years, because we have a beautiful story. We're storytellers, and we have this beautiful story. And we sometimes, when we design a game, we're like, let's just not do anything. Let's just go for a walk and just describe what we see when we open the box, or describe what we feel when we play the game. And it's poetic. we're in love with this game. We never made it. So yeah, that would be
wonderful to see. Okay, yeah. Good. So now we know what's going to happen in the future. At some point, it could be now, it could be in 10 years, whenever.
I wish I could say the title.
No. That's fine. Because then you can come and say, "Paco, I've done it," and then we can talk about it. Okay. It would be wonderful.
It's like the other one,
10
years.
Who knows? Exactly. That eureka moment. Okay, and the second question I had is, what would be the dream company to work for that you haven't worked for yet? What would that company look like?
I don't know, because right now the companies I work for are all so kick-ass, so great. I mean, I love working with Anya. Mm-hmm. I love the freedom. I love working with Ben Rider Games and Thunderworks Games, and they're both very different, but they're both awesome. And then there's Game on Tabletop, which they give me my freedom in a completely different way again, like I just told you what I'm doing for them. I love that too. Let me go back to Lego one more time.
Okay, that would be cool. That would be really...
See what they're doing right now? I didn't know.
You know, I think what should happen to you in the future, and I think this would be absolutely wonderful if it's actually Pixar came to you and said, we want games based on movies and that sort of thing. Do what you want.
Movies. But back to the, I can only stay awake for 10 minutes. That's not a good match.
Is it? Okay, that's interesting. That's very interesting, because I that's one thing that I look at movies, not just Pixar, which is a company that I do like a fair amount, but I do see. And I think there must be so many opportunities to make interesting little games based on what happens in the films.
Oh, exactly. And today I was talking to my physical therapist about things that are tax deductible. And I said, well, my Netflix account is tax deductible because I need to stay in touch with the geek culture. So, you know, and he's like, wow.
Well, I used to do that when I was a photographer in back in the UK. I would think all my holidays are tax deductible because I take photographs. You know, all the magazines I buy are tax deductible because I need them to be, a person.
The games, they're...
Yeah. Absolutely. So yeah, good, absolutely yes. Lisbeth, thank you so much for being with me today. It's been generally fantastic to getting to know you at last, and hopefully it will not be the last time.
Hopefully, live next time, like face to face.
Oh my God! You know, I am already saving money to go to Spiel this year.
Okay, good.
I haven't been back since 2017.
Okay.
And I am desperate because there are so many people that I only see when I go to Spiel, and I haven't seen them for 5 years. And I am just.
That's the only convention you go to?
I used to go, yes, because since I came to Spain, yes. And because traveling is not particularly cheap. And because this is a hobby, going to Spiel, me and my husband, is about 1,000 euros. If I go to the UK Games Expo, we're talking about another 500-600 euros. I wanted to go to Gen Con at some point, but that alone was going to be about 3,000 euros. It's a bit, how do I justify this? Yeah, I don't make money out of this. I do this because I love the hobby and I love the people hobby. Yeah. So it's a bit, I can't afford it. So yeah, Spiel is my favorite gig, and I love the Spiel atmosphere. It's super. I love it.
Yeah, I don't. The last couple of years, I didn't see Spiel because I was in the a special business lounge.
Right.
So I go there in the morning, and I can get in before the crowd gets in, and I leave when everybody's gone. And
I organize myself, so I do programmed interviews in the morning, and Martin and I come back from Spiel with about 45 to 50 interviews, and then in the afternoons I just wander around the halls discovering things just to see what I find.
Well, there is this new fair in Germany, Spieldoch. in dice builds.
I don't know. What...
Yeah, that's usually it. Well, they canceled, of course, also because of COVID. But that's usually, I believe, around now.
Okay.
It should be around now. And that's the only one Anya and I go to play games. Because otherwise we don't have time to play games. We're just, you know, having meetings and...
Yeah, you go for work. It's your job.
You go for work. So.
Well, maybe UK Games Expo might be a nice little break in May.
That will... June, isn't it? Is it in May?
I don't know. It used to be May, June. I don't know. Around that time.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember. I haven't looked, to be honest.
I thought it was in June. Yeah, but no, also that is work.
Oh, it's a shame because UK Games Expo is really brilliant. I really like it.
UK Games Expo is like, it's like Essen.
It's a mini Essen. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. When at one time I walked out of a booth and I'm like, why is everybody speaking English? It's like, oh, right, it's UK Games Expo. It's not the same feel.
Right, well, hopefully we will get to see each other face to face at one of those at some point. Thank you very much. Yes.
Okay, well, it was great to talk to you. Thank you for having me. Have a good night.
And this is it for today. Thank you very much indeed for being there. It is truly and genuinely appreciated. Please do get in touch. Email me or Chris at podcast@gmsmagazine.com and get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, or wherever you want. Just let us know and we'd love to be there and join us on our Discord server, which is not particularly active, but we would love it to be, and we do need you for that. This podcast has been produced by Paco Garcia with the help from Martin Reed and Chris Diaz. The music is by Kev Athsat. Thank you once again, and until the next time, game on.